National Radio Club.
This portion of Market Scope is brought to you by Magnetic Tapes. Without tapes, there would be no air checks.
IDXers, welcome to Market Scope for July 2013. There's nothing new into the Market Scope mailbox this month, so we've gone to our air check library and found a few old dusty air checks for your entertainment. The first two air checks were originally on Market Scope in 1994 and previewed call letter and format changes.
WSAI. From a charming collection called Day at the Movies, Doris Day and Tea for Two from the movie of the same name. Before that, John Denver and Take Me Home, Country Roads, on the station that takes you home to those great memories via the great songs. Thanks for coming along on this weekend. Here's Tom Jones and the green, green grass of home. WSAI, the only station that plays the original hits you love all the time.
This was WCKY Cincinnati. Now, 1530 WSAI News.
NBC Radio News. North Korea continues to thumb its nose at the international community.
Ordinary television on A&E. Consider it time well spent.
1530 WSAI. Every night I WSAI. Let me get a stick and knock the romance out of the air. The Three Sons in Twilight Time. And before that, Bobby Darin and Dream Lover. Hi, this is Bill Jones, and I'm a music lover. We've got great songs that bring back great memories. Such great folks as, well, we'll be hearing from Perry Como, Connie Francis, the Phantom, Michael Crawford, and a young lady who lost one of her most important assets the other night, her voice. We'll be hearing from Babs momentarily.
It's Memorial Day. Picnic time. Time to pile
by lecture.
Prices may vary. And always wear your seatbelt.
1530 WSAI. With the original hits that your memories are made of.
They have a mutual admiration society going, Michael Crawford and Barbara Streisand. They recorded together not too long ago. That's Michael and Stormy Weather from his CD, A Touch of Music in the Night. And before that, Barbara with People. You probably heard she has some vocal problems. Laryngitis has had to cancel, I'll put it this way, has had to postpone. Don't want to freak anyone out who may have a ticket to that, but anyway, she said to postpone four of her shows scheduled for the Anaheim Pond. What a great name for a venue, the Pond. But enough about that. It's 22 and a half after the hour. Here are the Ames Brothers.
Couple of jiggers of moonlight.
Yeah, great music, great kids. Some of your parents might remember that one, kids. Dueling Banjos, Eric Weisberg, and Steve Mandel. Old music on the station playing great music for great kids. I'm your pal, Paul, 21 minutes after the hour. I have another brain game again coming up next hour. A lot more great music this hour. Those Dueling Twins, Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen, Dennis Heisem, Ariel, Donnell. And we want to congratulate Amy and Pete from Blaine, Minnesota. They got married yesterday. Ding dong, and congratulations. Hope you have a great honeymoon. This is from Renee, wanting to wish you a very happy life together. All right, Amy and Pete getting married yesterday in Blaine, Minnesota. We'll be back on the station playing great music for great kids, Radio Oz.
There's a new baby at our house. Name is Jay.
only thing better than listening to a little Radio Oz is listening to AM 1360 Radio Oz in Cincinnati a lot. Great music for great kids. AM 1360 Radio Oz in Cincinnati.
Red Grammar, Cotton Fields on the station playing great music for great kids. And we're dedicating this next song to all the young women, young girls named Jennifer. Because this is about Jenny, the one and only bubblegum queen here on Radio Oz.
WQIO, Canton, where the music sounds best, just after 1 o'clock. This is Greg MacArthur with the BETs. Town on July 3rd, and all this weekend, we're going to get you to the music with free tickets to the concert at the Canton Civic Center. And with the free music station, Q10. Q10, WQIO is out of your back, girl. You stop for summer and hot stuff with Greg MacArthur at 109.
I want your business.
Q10 wheel in the summer, find your way with a Q-Van loaded up with prizes. And when you spot the red Q-Van, just give us a wave to let us know Q10 is your favorite station and win your share of the summer prizes. Q10 WQIO going up to get down. Paul Nicholas and have it on the seventh floor with Greg MacArthur at 122. Q10 WQIO with more of the best continuous music and the spinners and the games people play. And just hit on that Kenny Rogers and She Believes in Me. And this is Greg MacArthur at 136. Q10 at Greg MacArthur at 141 with thunderstorms likely through this evening becoming partly cloudy late tonight and tomorrow. Low tonight is 60 and a high Friday near 80. And in the city right now, it's 73 with Paul Davis. Ken and Greg MacArthur all ready to splash some cool summer cash your way. My 10 color goes diving for dollars in the Q10 money pool right now at 455-1060. Q10, that's it for me. Ron Foster is next with more of the best continuous music. Have a real good afternoon. We'll catch you back tomorrow. Q10, WQIO, Canton, where the music sounds best. Just after 2 o'clock, and it's Ron Foster with Steve Miller. Q10 with Dr. Hook rolling into town on July 3rd. And this weekend, we'll get you to the music with free tickets to the concert at the Canton Civic Center for the free music station, Q10. WQIO from the LP Sooner or Later. It's Rex Smith, and you take my breath away at 209.
Malls. Q10. Summer. More summer fun. And the new way to win easy money. Be ready to win cool summer cash from the Q10 Money Pool. $10, $20, $50, $100 bills. Just call in when you get the Q. Tell us which Q10 jack will dive into the money pool and win cash for you. Easy summer cash from the Q10 Money Pool.
WQIO. Q10 at 2:13 with Ron Foster. Thunderstorms are likely through this evening, becoming partly cloudy late tonight and tomorrow. Low tonight near 60 and a high Friday near 80. And in the city right now, it's 73. Q10 with the Q-Band on the road again this summer, and it is filled with more free prizes. Watch for it. The Q-Band, we'll let the summer fun your way all summer long. Q10. Q10, WQIO with Aerosmith and Dream On at 2:25 on a Thursday afternoon. This is Ron Foster, and the National Severe Storms Forecast Center in Kansas City has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for a large portion of Ohio, and that includes Wayne County in this area. Large hail and damaging thunderstorm winds are possible in the areas including Wayne County. For the rest of our immediate area, thunderstorms are likely through this evening, then becoming partly cloudy late tonight and tomorrow. Low tonight near 60 and a high Friday near 80, and in the city right now, it's 73. You're on Route 30. Hey, make plans to be at the
Civic Center this Saturday night at 8 o'clock when all of us here at Q10, along with other Stark County DJs, take on the elected officials from all around Stark County in a benefit basketball game for Easter Seals. NBA stars Nick Witherspoon of San Diego and Campy Russell, the Cavs, will be celebrity coaches, and tickets are on sale now at all participating McDonald's.
The best music.
Q10 splashes cool cash your way all summer long. Your chance to dive for dollars and win up to $100 cash from the Q10 money pool happens when you get the cue to call from the station with easy summer money. WQIO with more of the best continuous music and Meatloaf from the LP Bat Out of Hell and 2 Out of 3 Ain't Bad, and just ahead of that, Ricky Lee Jones and Chuck E's In Love at 2:39.
Q10 with more free summer music. Tuesday night, July 3rd, Dr. Hook in concert at the Canton Civic Center. And this weekend, Q10 gets you the music. This weekend, be ready to win free tickets to the Dr. Hook concert and free Pleasure and Pain LPs.
On the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Dr. Hook in concert at the Canton Civic Center Tuesday night, July 3rd. And the free music this weekend from Q10.
Q10 Ron Foster at 2:44 on a Thursday afternoon. The National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for a large portion of Ohio, and included in that are Wayne County. Large hail and damaging thunderstorm winds are possible in the areas until 8 o'clock tonight. For the rest of our immediate area, thunderstorms are likely through this evening, then becoming partly cloudy late tonight and tomorrow. It's 73 right now. The concert information station with complete concert details all summer long, 24 hours a day on the Q10 concert line at 477-8880. Q10 WQIO with Anita Ward and Ring My Bell. This is Ron Foster at 251. Dover exit. Hey, the downtown Canton YMCA is taking registration for summer camp for kids 6 to 12 years of age. And the program offers swimming, baseball, nature hikes, pony riding, a lot of other activities. Transportation is provided by the YMCA. And for more information, you can call the downtown Y at 456-7141.
Ron Foster, WQIO.
Carry on my wayward son.
Music sounds best just after 3 o'clock. This is Ron Foster with the Brothers Johnson. Full stocked with cool summer cash. When you get the cue, just call in to go diving for dollars and come up with free money.
I hope you enjoyed that look back. That 20 to 30 plus years back, it's no surprise that all those formats are long gone. If you'd like to help us out here at the Market Scope and share the radio from your hometown or from your travels, send your recordings to me, Phil Wayne, at 7545 County Highway 71, Harpster, Ohio, 43323-9364. I look forward to hearing from you, and the DX Audio Service thanks you in advance. I hear mumblings. Yes, it's the mumblings and musings from the members on the DX Audio Service.
Musings from members.
Greetings, DX Audio Service members. This is Terry Livingston Hughes in Los Angeles. I visited Costa Mesa last weekend, and I was anxious to check out the nighttime performance of 740 KBRT Costa Mesa. Even within Costa Mesa itself at night, one could null out KBRT simply by rotating the radio a 90-degree turn. If that's possible within the City of License, and the City of License isn't too far from the city where the transmitter is located, why would the FCC license nighttime operation for a station when it's going to be in competition with 740 KCBS San Francisco, one of the great powerhouses of the Pacific Coast? I'll take anyone's thoughts on that. I'm really surprised that the FCC would license nighttime operation even at 174 watts of power for this station. It seems to serve no useful purpose if the layman listener, who's not really that cognizant of what goes on with AM radio, can avoid receiving the signal if the radio is turned for them the wrong way. for us the right way, then why would the FCC give this station license to operate 24 hours a day? 73s and good DX. Bye-bye.
Hello to everybody on Musings for Members. This is Dale Ham in Kansas City. I will be attending the NRC convention August 1st through the 4th. I do have a room reserved. If a member is seeking to share the rooms with me, please let me know, and I'll be glad to, you know, help share the expenses. I do have a room reserved. You can reach me at area code 816-255-3404. See you there in Minneapolis.
Hi, this is Mike Lance in Aventura, Florida. I'll be attending the National Radio Club Convention in Bloomington, Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I'm looking forward to meeting some wonderful people where we could talk about radio in your part of the country, and we can also talk about DXing in your part of the country. Well, I have a few questions. Number one, at one time, you could listen to a ball game on the radio, and you could hear the crowd noise and everything going on in the stadium. Today, if you listen to a ball game, it's very, very low. You can hardly hear what's going on in the stadium. In fact, if you're listening to a radio station with a ball game at a stadium, the ball game is delayed by about 10 seconds. Why are radio stations doing that? I would like to know. Whatever happened to the original 24-hour-a-day radio station, 1230 KGFJ in Los Angeles, KABL in San Francisco, and WILD in Boston, I understand, is now Chinese from New York, Radio China International. I would like to know how to get in touch with them. You take care, and I hope to see you at the National Radio Club Convention.
This is John Wesley Smith from Hallsville, Missouri. A couple of format changes to report here in the Midwest. I noticed on one evening in early July during a Cubs game break on 1290 WIRL from Peoria, they mentioned that they're now doing Good Time Oldies, and they had been doing Classic Country for a while. And then I was in St. Louis on July 5th, and 1380 is now doing a woman's talk format, calling themselves The Woman. I can't imagine that that format's going to last very long. It might last longer than I think, but that station on 1380 seems to change formats every couple of years. And the last one that they had before going to the woman's format was local sports talk.
And that is our musings to the members on this edition of the DX Audio Service. And to answer Mike Lance's question about the press box and why the audio sounds the way it does, well, there's probably two reasons for the audio delay. One is just in case of profanity, and the other is probably the circuit is going through a digital system. And anytime you go through a digital system, there's a little bit of a delay, or what they call latency, in the transmission. So there's nothing subversive there, or the radio station's not causing it. It's simply a technical function. As far as the radio stations you asked about, hopefully some members can answer those questions, as I'm personally not familiar with those stations. So hopefully some other DX Audio Service members can chime in just by calling the Musings line at 419-741-0205 24 hours a day. Now let's get to some news.
Our draft agenda is out, and you're running out of time to register for the Joint DX Club Convention, August 1st to the 4th in Minneapolis. So far on the agenda, on Thursday, we are working on a trip to the Mall of America. We'll have the opportunity for a baseball game, and we're also trying to work up a DXpedition at a nearby RF site. Friday, Nick Hall Patch. We'll be talking about the DX Fish Barrel. Intriguing title? Indeed, intriguing topic. We'll have Neil Kazaros talking about Chasing Sunset, Skip. We'll talk about dealing with interference on small AM antennas. And we'll have a working lunch on new, state-of-the-art antenna frontiers. Then we spend the afternoon and most of Saturday at the Pavick Museum of Broadcasting, including museum tours at this world-renowned broadcast and communications museum. We'll hear about Don Moman's antenna farm in Canada, about the FSL antenna that's making so much noise, pardon the pun, out west, advancements in medium wave antennas, hot new ideas by, and then we'll be doing tours of the museum. Friday night, a pizza fest at the museum, our business meetings, and then we'll spend some time in gab fests. On Saturday, we're going to hear about the quest for the perfect loop antenna, review shortwave listening in the 21st century, a practical view. We'll see what's going on above medium wave. We'll hear about ultralight radio receivers, and we'll look at a nifty new receiver that's just hit the market. Then some show and tell time, and we may have another transmitter tour lined up. We haven't got that set yet. Saturday night's banquet. Our guest speaker is Dean Sorensen. Dean is a DXer himself. He's a member of the DX Audio Service and a longtime group radio broadcaster. That'll be followed by our combined auction. Sunday morning, the great DX quiz, the Scott Feibusch Tower Tour, and Sunday afternoon, you have the option of attending the Minnesota Twins-Houston Astros game at Target Field. To register or to get further information on the combined DX Club convention, just go to www.nrcdxas.org or keep listening to our broadcast.
You're listening to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service.
It's not very often when a commissioner of the FCC corresponds directly with a radio or television station owner. In this case, an owner of a daytime AM station in a small town in Wisconsin. But here's the give and take between the owner of radio station WRDN in Durand, Wisconsin, and Commissioner Ajit Pai of the Federal Communications Commission. First, the letter from WRDN. Dear Commissioner Pai, thank you for meeting with me and discussing issues facing the AM radio band. As we discussed, my wife and I are co-owners of WRDN AM in Durand, Wisconsin. Our station serves the county seats of Pepin, Buffalo, and Wabasha counties with local radio. This station had been effectively off the air for 5 years before we put it back on the air in April of 2012. Had my wife and I not purchased the license and put the station back on the air, Durand, Mondovi, and Alma would all have no local radio service. We strive to serve our local community, and I have included some letters from area residents and leaders about why our small AM station is important to the area. My wife and I would like to personally thank you for your concern about revitalizing the AM band. Recently, at the NAB conference in Las Vegas, you held a discussion about how to help revitalize the AM band. There are many different ideas, but many will cost small broadcasters like myself too much money to implement. Here are some of the ideas. Number one, let AM stations broadcast on FM translators. This has been going on, but only on existing translators. Since there is no available FM translator in Durand, I can't do this unless I purchase one and then hop it, making small moves toward Durand until I can use it. I'm not allowed to just move into Durand all at once. Each one of these hops costs money in engineering and FCC fees and could take years to complete. Number two, digital AM. This is coming from Ubiquity Corporation. We would have to pay them for the technology every year and would have to totally replace all our transmitting equipment. Since most people do not have radios that receive digital AM, this is not very feasible. Number three, expand the FM band and put AM stations on that new band. Again, radios can't receive these new frequencies, so there would be that time lag, and I would be forced to totally replace all our transmitting and antenna equipment. It is my belief the easiest thing the FCC could do is the following. A. Start enforcing the Part 15 interference rules. TVs, computer monitors, fluorescent lights, overhead electric lines, and other consumer products are not allowed to cause interference. The FCC has been pretty lax in enforcing that. Want to get rid of all the buzzing, etc.? Let's clean that up first. B. Let the AM broadcasters broadcast again with high bandwidth. Right now, the NRSC rule prohibits us from anything over 9 kHz bandwidth. Factor that with most radios that only allow 3 kHz to be received, and that is why AM sounds like a phone call. AM used to sound much better. C. This will be the most controversial among radio engineers.
Get rid of the 1930s rules forcing many AM stations to lower power at night. This rule was started because at night, AM can go farther via Skywave. In 1930, it might have been important to have large regional stations serving a large rural area, and small stations like us had to clear the channel. But that is not the case any longer. Our station must lower power at night to protect a station in St. Louis, Missouri. While I like oldies, our biggest complaints are that at night people in Durand can't get us. Instead, they hear this station in St. Louis. They ask me why. I tell them I have to lower power, and they all say, "Well, that's just silly. We don't care about St. Louis, and they don't care about us." I believe that all stations should be allowed at least 2,000 watts, and if they have a higher night power level, that's fine. They can keep that. Many radio engineers will say it causes more interference, but that would only happen in the fringe areas. In our case, areas to our south, and for St. Louis, areas to their north. But for both of us, those areas are out of our local listening area. I wouldn't jam St. Louis or Mankato, Minnesota or Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. And they wouldn't jam me because we would all be at a higher power and would cancel each other out outside of our local areas. But in reality, our listeners don't care about technicalities. They just know they can't get us, so they don't listen. There are many local stations across the country that would do local sports, etc., but figure it's not worth it when people can't hear the signal. My suggestion is this. The FCC issue a temporary rule allowing all stations that have low night power to increase it to their daytime power level to a max of 2,000 watts. Stations that already have a higher power at night can keep it. Do this from September 1st to March 31st as a test to see how bad it would really be. Let all the broadcasters know so we can plan on having local programming at night, like high school sports. I'm betting that this would work just fine and the FCC could just leave the rule in place. If there is an issue with a station causing unacceptable interference, it would be as simple as having the station then lower power to a point where the interference is gone. By allowing this, it would help small broadcasters without a huge investment. We could use what we are currently using for transmitting equipment, our local listeners would benefit with local programming, and the business sponsors would benefit too. Of course, this won't help revitalize the AM band if broadcasters continue to ignore their local communities and only have programming that is cheap and easy to air, but provides nothing to their communities. I'm not sure how the FCC could enforce having stations with local programming other than through the public service portion of the broadcast license. Commissioner Pye, I would like to invite you to visit us in Durand sometime, and we can show you our station and how we serve our community and what it's like to try and receive the station at night. I would also like to thank you again for meeting with me. It is not often that high-level government officials are willing to take some of their valuable time to meet with the average citizen. Again, it is a testament to your commitment to all broadcasters, large and small, that you were willing to meet with me. I would also like to say thank you to the rest of the FCC staff that has helped us with license renewal and other questions that we have had. You and your staff are an example of how government should work. Thanks again. If you have any questions, feel free to drop me an email or give me a call. Sincerely, Brian Winnikins, co-owner, WRDN, Durand, Wisconsin. And now, here's the statement of Commissioner Ajit Pai on WRDN Real Country, 1430 AM. Durand, Wisconsin is a small town of about 1,900 people. Sit on the banks of the Chippewa River, Durand is about 200 miles northeast of Madison, 80 miles southeast of Minneapolis, and 30 miles west of Eau Claire, a straight shot along Wisconsin Trunk 85. I have never been to Durand, although I hope to go someday, but I know many towns like it, including the one where I grew up. In places like Durand, a local radio station is an important way, sometimes one of the only ways, for folks to feel like they really are part of the community. On May 13, 2013, I had the pleasure of meeting with Brian Winnikins of Durand. Brian and his wife Carla own and operate WRDN Real Country 1430 AM. Brian talked to me about the invaluable service WRDN provides to people in and around Durand, and about some of the problems his station faces. Brian also gave me a folder full of letters. The first letter described some of his ideas for improving the AM band. The rest of the letters were from citizens of Durand. They mentioned how grateful they were to Brian and Carla for buying the license to WRDN and bringing it back on the air in 2012, after 5 years of radio silence.
They discussed how much they appreciated having radio coverage of local events like high school sports. WRDN is home to the Durand Panthers, and several noted that WRDN helped local residents who were elderly or physically impaired stay informed about goings-on around town, such as church services and weather updates. These letters had a strong impact on me. With Brian's permission, and after making redactions of certain personal information, I've posted the letters along with this statement so that you can read them too. It's no secret that I am a fan of AM radio, and it's no revelation that I'd like the Federal Communications Commission to start an initiative to revitalize the AM band. I hope that the words of these Wisconsinites, along with the everyday hard work of AM operators like Brian and Carla Winnikins, help illustrate why it's important for us to do so. There are so many people in the Durands of America who could benefit from that effort. For the DX Audio Service, I'm Wally Warrow in Dallas, Texas.
This article is entitled Last Stand for the AM Band. It was written by Guy Wire, that's a pseudonym for a veteran broadcast radio engineer, in RadioWorld.com. The AM Band has been in deep trouble for a long time. AM stations struggle almost everywhere to be successful, even many big signal facilities in large markets. A growing number of owners seem to have little interest in improving or fully supporting their AM properties. Their FM sisters subsidize the expenses to keep them alive. And sadly, more AM stations are going dark as licenses are simply being turned in and their assets liquidated. FM surged into the lead as the preferred broadcast band for the majority of radio's audiences almost 30 years ago. Internet delivery eventually will challenge FM's dominance. Nobody would disagree that other bands and technologies are much better suited than AM to drive our industry forward. Has the time arrived to give up the noise and interference-infested senior broadcast band to the power companies for load bank switching and move on? FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai, along with a significant group of AM owners and aligned interests, doesn't think so. Pai has been a welcome breath of fresh air for AM fans everywhere since he announced his full support for AM revitalization. He moderated a panel on the topic and led the discussion at April's National Association of Broadcasters show, the first time in history a sitting FCC commissioner has done so. As Radio World editor Michael LeClaire pointed out in the previous issue, we've done all the small stuff to help save AM radio, and it hasn't worked. In spite of its best intentions, many of the FCC rules enacted since AM began declining have actually stifled its ability to survive and thrive. We've reached a tipping point for AM. Tweaking existing rules won't likely go deep enough or far enough to help. The band needs big and bold ideas with implementation to save it long term. Pai's NAB panel discussion tackled all the various options and so-called solutions to the AM problem. Every one entails considerable caveats and conditions that make them difficult to execute and become effective. Every engineer and communications attorney will probably have a different opinion about how realistic, doable, and effective each could be. Let's take a look at the various proposed solutions being tossed around. I'll list them in order of doability and effectiveness according to my own crystal ball. Number one, FCC allowing AM stations more flexibility to seek out, move, and acquire FM translators to simulcast their programming on a priority one to a customer basis. Granting the pending Tell City waiver request set the precedent for many AMs constrained by the strict limits on moves of FM translator transmitter sites and channel modifications. Compared to all the other options, this is by far the easiest, but it would mostly only help stations in smaller markets outside the larger metro areas that are able to find and purchase a commercial channel translator in a wider radius around their AM stations. This buys some extra time dime for the lucky stations that get a translator until all digital AM becomes standardized, or until the band dies completely, or if internet and WiMAX delivery makes over-the-air AM/FM broadcasting useless. Most of us won't be around when that happens. Number two, FCC opening an AM-only filing window for FM translators. Some broadcasters are advocating for an AM-only window for filing for FM translators in addition to a grant of the Tel City waiver. This could help some additional stations in the smaller markets if the required rulemaking to create the window is accomplished quickly. With many of the pending LPFM applications filed back in 2003 now being granted, the availability of channels will shrink dramatically. Rulemakings usually take years to enact. With time running out for AM analog, the FCC should fast-track such a proceeding and also give existing AMs priority to acquire older translator licenses that are not renewed for any reason. Option 3. FCC setting an AM analog sunset date and mandating conversion to all digital by that date. Most clear-thinking owners and operators of the nation's still successful AM stations see this option as the best long-term solution for saving AM. Even though only a few hundred existing stations have adopted hybrid analog-digital AM, enough time has elapsed to establish a de facto standard as our only realistic option. Ubiquiti's all-digital AM/HD. I realize that much of the industry is still not happy that Ubiquiti remains private and proprietary and won't share its code so others might contribute to its improvement. We can only hope that will eventually change. An FCC mandate that all new radios sold must include HD capability would give this option a huge boost. HD radio receivers in the hands of consumers now can already receive all-digital AM/HD. It's going to be very difficult to establish this mandate since the CEA and other interests will undoubtedly fight it, but it's the only ace card we have left to play in the AM band if the game is going to continue. Option 4, FCC rescinding various existing counterproductive and outdated rules. Those include the ratchet clause for AM nighttime interference protection limits, the required 80% city of license coverage requirement, and the necessity for minimum efficiency AM antennas. These could all be rescinded fairly easily if the commission made it a priority. The so-called ratchet clause mostly prevented many stations from investing in meaningful signal coverage improvements since it required reduced coverage in the null areas. Removing the 80% city of license rule would allow a few marginal stations to be able to relocate sites, but probably lose important coverage. Being able to use short antennas would also enable some stations to relocate and reduce antenna construction expense, but realistically, removing those roadblocks would do little to help most AM stations now. It's like running a garden hose into the ocean to raise the tide. Number 5. FCC adopting tougher rules limiting noise levels emitted by electrical and electronic devices. RF light bulbs and all kinds of consumer and industrial devices that are powered by electricity and emit RF would have to be regulated for this option to be effective. And that includes those nasty power lines, noisy transformers, and electric mass transit offenders. But even if the commission could adopt tougher rules in the face of CEA and other opposition, trying to enforce them would create a bureaucratic nightmare for an already understaffed and underfunded FCC. Except for Commissioner Pai, it's becoming rather obvious the FCC doesn't really care that much about AM receiver noise interference. In any case, with many billions of AM noise-generating devices already out in the world, there is no way to put that Pandora back in the box. It's the wireless Wi-Fi and WiMAX bands they want to protect going forward. Number 6, FCC adopting and enforcing better AM analog receiver specs to mitigate noise interference. The FCC could establish guidelines like the preferred use of digital signal processing, synchronous detectors, and better noise suppression designs in receivers. Enacting any hard rules for receiver performance benchmarks would no doubt bring Consumer Electronics Association opposition. That's the CEA we've been talking about. As in number 4, enforcing new rules would be very difficult with so many radios coming in as imports, plus the existence of a billion radios already in use. As with the AMAX initiative, remember that, this issue will likely only get lip service. Option 7, FCC granting across-the-board power increases to existing stations. While this sounds like a good idea, the amount of power increase needed to be effective to override today's very high environmental noise levels would have to be many times higher than existing levels to do any good. Merely doubling or tripling power levels would produce little improvement in most locales. Implementing very high power increases for most existing stations is simply not economic or realistic, and there are the international treaties on foreign clear and shared channels regarding interference protection, which would be very difficult to renegotiate. Option 8, FCC allowing cellular-type repeaters for AM stations to augment coverage. This might be the most unrealistic pie-in-the-sky idea in the entire list. The complexity and expense of implementation and maintenance in most cases vastly outweighs any potential improvement and return. Only a very few FM stations are seriously looking at this option. Why would struggling AMs even consider it? Option 9, FCC allowing the migration of existing AM stations to channels 5 and 6, 76 to 88 megahertz. This plan was first presented in detail in 2008 by a group called the Broadcasting Maximization Committee. They proposed using a modified all-digital 100 kilohertz channel scheme so that all existing AM stations could fit into 12 megahertz of new spectrum with room for some other goodies. It could also be done using analog or hybrid analog digital. This idea has received significant radio industry support, with proponents assuming the new channels would be awarded for free in exchange for eventually vacating AM. But existing TV stations still using these channels, along with many dozens of LPTV applicants wanting the spectrum, makes this a difficult sell for both the NAB and FCC. Plus, there are too many business reasons this plan is a non-starter. The government and the commission are looking for new sources of revenue, so they favor auctioning off spectrum for new uses to the highest bidder. Most spectrum reallocation and repurposing initiatives have been paid for by the new users via auction. In this case, the displaced users will want compensation, so the FCC would likely require existing AM station owners migrating into the 76 to 88 MHz band to pay something. Without ready-to-use radio receivers for any new 76 to 88 megahertz channel 5-6 spectrum in the hands of U.S. consumers, the extra burden of not only paying for and operating a new FM channel along with maintaining the existing AM station until enough new FM receivers are in use makes this option unappealing as a business model. Best possibilities. It's rather obvious to me that the most feasible options boil down to awarding as many FM translators to existing AMs as possible, and then mandating an analog sunset in favor of all digital AM. The last several options will have little meaningful impact even if adopted. I don't see expanding available spectrum for radio ever happening. It's becoming clear with each passing year that the analog AM band has become less and less desirable for much of anything. Its prospects in an all-digital world change significantly, as evidenced by the recent all-digital field testing in North Carolina. The grapevine is saying several major group CEOs have suggested a 10-year sunset limit on analog AM radio. After that, all digital should be mandated. HD radio sales and penetration continues to grow at a slow but steady pace. 10 years seems reasonable, since that's the average lifespan of cars in regular use, and many new cars now include HD radios capable of receiving AM HD. I'm betting that many existing AM licensees of marginal stations would be willing to give them up if the FCC and NAB could craft an attractive incentive to do so. If the stations that want to keep them can migrate to FM translators, the band will at least partially cleanse itself. That leaves a real opportunity for those owners who see long-term value in the advantages of keeping the AM band alive with new and improved technology. For the all-digital AM-HD mandate to happen, the FCC and broadcasters alike are going to have to muster some real courage and perseverance to get it done. Commissioner Pai has a unique opportunity to change the course of history. Otherwise, the AM branch will simply wither and die on the electromagnetic vine. And that article was written by Guy Wire in the June 17, 2013 issue of Radio World Online. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service.
One of the components to radio broadcasting is the audio processor. This device is usually appearing just before the transmitter in the audio chain and serves to control overmodulation, audio which is too loud or too soft. In the early days of broadcasting, the audio processor did not really exist. It was simply a technician with his hand on the control adjusting the level. Later on, the audio gain controller, AGC, took over. It was a single band unit looking at all the audio frequencies. And then in the 70s, the discriminant audio processor by Mike DeRoe showed up. It had three different bands of audio processing, and this was what gave stations such as KHJ in their heyday that unique sound. Well, since then, audio processing has evolved, and now it's pretty much all digital. But this is the Audio Prism story by Glenn Clark. This article appeared in the broadcaster's desktop resource. The Audio Prism was a design born of desperation. It was 1979, and the OptiMod 8100 was still in the future. The coin of the realm at the time for a major market rock station was a pair of DeRoe DAP 310s in front of an OptiMod 8000. I was working at an oldies FM station in Pittsburgh, owned by the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. The call letters at the time were WPEZ. Today it's known as 3WS. Our arch rival was the Hearst Broadcasting FM station across the street, WXKX, also known as 96 Kicks. It was a knockdown, drag-out fight. Our program director, the PD, was a very able Big Jim Edwards, a.k.a. James K. Davis of CKLW and WLS fame. Their PD was equally capable, Bobby Christian, who had come from Phoenix and would later go to Minneapolis. We both did anything and everything possible to gain even the slightest advantage both in programming and technology. Then the loudness war erupts. One morning, our air staff got in their cars to go to work and noticed that we were getting hammered in the loudness war by 96 Kicks. After a brief staff meeting to talk about the new balance of power, we came to the conclusion that the competition must simply have their FM deviation set to an illegal level, perhaps by accidents. Jim Davis and I went around to the master control room and dialed around the FM band, expecting to confirm that 96 Kicks was overmodulating. Much to our surprise, we found out that 96 Kicks was completely legal. Their average modulation was clearly higher than anyone else on the dial, but their peaks were under 100%. Good news and bad news followed. The good news was that it didn't take too long to figure out what 96 Kicks' new secret weapon was. A chatty weekend disc jockey who worked at both stations and was hoping to land a full-time job with WPEZ in return for some information was happy to tell us that 96 Kicks had just installed one of them brand new CRL System 4 systems for FM. We had never heard of CRL. Neither had many other people at the time. They just suddenly appeared, like a meteor out of the sky. That was the good news. We were forced to take another route. The bad news was that we couldn't get one for ourselves. It seemed that Bobby Christian, the program director for 96 Kicks, was friends with the president of CRL. They had worked together in Phoenix.
And for some reason, CRL just never seemed to be able to find an FM4 system to send to WPEZ. Imagine that. WPEZ's DAP 310 and Optimod 8000 combination were light years ahead of what was replaced, but there was no combination of settings for the WPEZ airchain that was going to catch up with the CRL System 4. The System 4 was more advanced technology, and it was going to take new technology to equal it. The only solution for us was to develop a new technology in-house. The deadline we set for ourselves was the day before the next Arbitron rating period started. We had just 2 months. Since there was no other processor in the commercial market that could beat the CRL system, the ball was in my court. So I headed to the laboratory. Processing Ninja background. Fortunately, I had been thinking about processing, developing my own ideas and concepts for quite a while, especially since my days as chief engineer at WLS-FM in Chicago from 1972 to 1974, where I was responsible for the audio processing on both the FM and the AM. I know that today people stick in the latest digital box in the rack, play with the presets for 3 days, and then just forget about it. In 1972, it was a completely different world. If you were in a market ranked higher than number 10, you were rolling your own. There was too much at stake to just go out of the box with hardware. If you were a major market chief engineer, you had to be a processing ninja. Going against strong competition, WLS AM's arch rival at the time was WCFL. Unfortunately, they were not just any pushover. Their sharp engineer, Jim Lupus, had a much better transmitter plant than we did. And to top it off, they were located much closer to the downtown than we were, putting over 3 times as much RF into downtown Chicago, 50 millivolts per meter from WCFL to our 15 millivolts per meter from WLS. The WCFL transmitter was the Continental 317C, which had greater fidelity and modulated well over 100% on positive peaks. Our General Electric was reliable, but did not sound as bright, nor would it go past 100%. So as you can imagine, doing a processing battle with WCFL was pretty much a full-time job in itself. The point is that if you were a chief engineer of a rock station in the top 5 market in 1972, you were not just putting factory stock processing on the air any more than NASCAR teams run a factory stock Chevy Malibu at the Dayton 500. You were constantly thinking about how to modify, enhance, and augment the current processing state of art. There was no course that you could take back then, nor any one book that you could read to learn the craft. It was just a matter of knowing the music and exploring the interaction from each processing adjustment, and what was the impact that would be made on the high-frequency clipper 7 stages further downstream. You had to feel it in your bones. Building a better mousetrap. Having such a background, I was able to go back to the lab, and just in time, 2 months later, to unveil the first audio prisms on the air at 2 p.m. on the day before the next Arbitron started. In 1979, the secret to increased loudness was to make the attack and recovery time constants faster, but there were limits to this. A VCA is just a 2-quadrant multiplier, so as long as there is just a DC or quasi-DC on the control input, the output will just be a scaled copy of the input. But if the control starts moving fast enough that there is a noticeable AC component on top of the DC, modulation takes place in the multiplier and the output has some and different frequencies that were not present in the VCA audio input. It gets ugly real fast. So the biggest goal in the audio prism was to make the control voltage move fast, but to still not have lots of AC on it. This sounds like a big contradiction until you realize that about 80% of the moves made by the AGC voltage will be retraced within the following second. So, if you only react to events that last for more than a second, the AC on the control line falls to a smaller fraction of what it would have been otherwise. Reaction standoff allows the audio prism to deliver the same loudness as anything then on the market, but with a much cleaner sound. The right number of gates. The second goal we set for the audio prism was to have individual gates on each of the four bands. On processors with a single master gate, bad things could happen. For example, if there was audio in the lower frequency band and no audio above 8 kHz, the master gate would allow the high band to keep working, and the high band would just go chase tape hiss. So we knew from the outset that we had to have individual gates for each band. By the way, I am sure talking about tape hiss. I know this sounds strange today, but in 1979, DVDs were still in the laboratory. The most common music source for major market rockers at the time was the ITC triple deck cart machine. After 30 or 40 plays, even with the expensive formulated 3M oxide, the tape hiss would be a problem for the processor. So, the two most obvious things about the audio prism that we did differently were to reduce the AC on the control lines to the VCAs to have them individually gating on all four bands. The three extra cookies. There was also a few of what computer people call cookies in the audio prism. A cookie, by the way, is an undocumented feature. My three cookies were Berwyn-style noise reduction, some odd-order sweetening along the lines of the Aphex oral exciter, and some subtle stereo enhancement. Noise reduction was the first cookie. Eliminating tape hiss so that the processor did not turn the fade at the end of a record into 100% modulation, which sounded like the surf coming in on the beach. I am sure that it is hard to imagine today, given digital sources and digital scrub masters, but back in 1979, fighting tape hiss was a major activity on any station. One of the more effective devices to reduce tape hiss at the time was the Berwyn noise filter. It was a very effective, single-ended system that you can insert between the console and the audio processor. If you wanted to pay the considerable but well-deserved cost for the device, the Dolby noise reduction systems were slightly more effective. But they were a double-ended system. That meant that every music cartridge on the playlist had to be recorded with a Dolby encoder, and you could not just play a generic music tape through the Dolby playback unit. The Berwyn unit was about as good as you could get with a single-ended unit. The audio prism did not step on the Berwyn patents, but every audio prism, in effect, had a free Berwyn noise filter in it. No one was ever going to find out about it because it didn't exist in any particular location. It was not a circuit. It was just a way of handling the gain budget that got to the same result. We never included this in any of the sales brochures because we did not want to tell Texar's competitors what their next feature should be. But after using the prisms on the air for about an hour, people knew that there was something cleaner about how it handled crossfades, even if they did not know what it was. A sweet sound. A second cookie was sound sweetening. This careful attention of certain harmonics can make a radio station sweeter to listen to, even if the result does not look quite as good on a distortion analyzer. Marvin Cesar is found of telling people that after hearing the Aphex oral exciter, Linda Ronstadt insisted on re-recording an entire side of that album that she had already completed. The lesson there was that perfect reproduction is not the most pleasing. In fact, Doug Howland from Chancellor once described one of the early digital processors as the audio hospital. He meant that it was surgically pure and accurate in a way that could be measured with a meter, but was boring as heck to listen to on the air. The photoconductive cells used for the VCA on the M100 cards were not the lowest distortion VCA you could find with a meter, but the choice of the photoconductive cell for the VCAs in the audio prism was a way of sneaking some sound sweetening into the prism without stepping on the Aphex patents. It was also a way to deliver the feature to the customer without calling attention to it in a brochure or in a manual. Doing it in stereo. The last of three cookies in the audio prism was stereo enhancement. This enhancement was not approached as overly as in some of the dedicated stereo enhancers. The Texar approach did not fatten the off-air Lesargus pattern to the extent that the dedicated stereo enhancers did, but it also did not make the fringe of the FM service area pull in either. As with noise reduction cookie in the audio prism, there was no stereo enhancement circuit per se. The stereo enhancement was accomplished by tailoring the behavior of the main processor algorithm in a subtle way. So there was no dedicated circuit to tip off our competition to the stereo enhancement cookie. Unless you looked really hard at an off-air feed on a scope, you would have never discovered it. Success. The result was pretty good. I never stopped to save any of the Arbitron reports to document it, but Jim Davis, the program director at WPEZ, went from being manic to being content within 24 hours after the prisms went on the air. One of the hallmarks of the audio prism was longer time spent listening. Our quarter hour to cum ratio was always higher than the average processor. Packaging the product. As you can understand, serial number 1 and number 2 were not that refined. They were not designed to be manufactured in volume. They were built to stop the fact that Hurst and 96 Kicks was hammering us in the face with their new CRL processor. The concept was the same when B-29 bombers were sent to the war in the Pacific with Boeing technicians on board, assembling the planes in flight. That's how desperate the Pentagon was to stop the loss of life at Iwo Jima and Guadalcanal. This was the same kind of thing. In desperation to get to the finish line, serial number 1 and 2 were fragile, crude, inside and out. The front panel was chopped up with a Greenlee hole saw and a Black & Decker drill. They were not very pretty. You could say they had a face for radio. But we hit the air with serial number 1 and number 2 at 11 p.m. the night before the Arbitron started. We were not thinking ahead to sell these units in volume. Only our thoughts were to just get it on the air. Immediately, we started working on number 3 and number 4, largely because we had no idea how long 1 and 2 would keep working. The project became the solution for stations in heavy competitive battles. By 1986, the audio prism was seen almost everywhere. It was called by many as an overnight success. It just took 7 years to get to it. Before long, its sibling appeared. The laser analog processor, complete with a built-in stereo generator, was displayed at the 1988 National Association of Broadcasters show, just before we sold the company to Gentner. And now you know how a crash program to keep WPEZ competitive in the Pittsburgh market led to what became a classic audio product in the world of audio processing. By the way, Glenn Clark continues to watch the broadcast industry from his office in Pittsburgh, taking on challenging projects that push the boundaries of technology. You can write to Glenn at glen@clarkcom, clarkcom.com. And that's it for the July edition of the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service. We'll see you in less than 30 days with more DX stuff, because we're a little late in getting this magazine out. Until then, 73 good DX, and get out and support. Radio.